I see that, according to my notes, the last time I talked to you was on November 22nd, 1982. That's kind of a lot. It's 4 years.
What was that? Was that Grace Abounding?
That was Grace Abounding.
Huh.
Yeah, that was Grace.
Yeah,
yeah. It was Grace Abounding.
Yeah.
And somehow it didn't seem that long. It seemed,
I know. It didn't seem that long to me either. But
it seemed like only like a year or so ago.
Yeah.
How have you been? What have you been doing?
I know you have the essay book.
You did the essay
book. And that was interesting to do. I read and read and read and read before I could decide what I wanted to use in that. Enjoyed that a lot. And been teaching. You know, I tend to... I guess I keep overly busy. I don't know why that is. Maybe I'm not actually overly busy, but I'm teaching. I just finished the semester at Yale, but I've been at Columbia before that. But writing hard, you know, doing some journalism and all, but I really think of the new book as 3 years of my life. So that adds up from the time that we last saw each other to now. It fills in.
Well, you haven't been keeping yourself dull by any stretch of the imagination, have you?
No, I haven't. I've been working away.
Commute up to New Haven? Is that what you do?
I commute to New Haven and stay overnight in one college or another, teach one seminar on the Tuesday and the next on the next day. And sort of work from the minute when you do something like that and concentrate your time, you work from the minute you hit the deck until you get out of town.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun. I mean, I really enjoy bright undergraduates a lot. They're so flexible and ready for anything. You learn a lot from them. I like that.
It's still creative writing?
Well, some of it was called nonfiction. One class, one seminar was called nonfiction. So there were people doing essays and people doing remarkable things. There was one nice guy who I had in my class, who Joe Levy, who had started the rock paper at Yale, the rock criticism, and he wrote, "You'd be surprised how much I know about rock and roll now. How up on everything I am." He wrote these terrific essays on... they were sort of album reviews is what they were, but he had a real backlog of knowledge, of a sort of a history that he drew upon, and he did a marvelous job. I don't know what he'll do with that.
Kind of a pop Nat Hentoff, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, exactly.
He's probably lusting for the Rolling Stone.
Yeah, he was, yes, exactly.
A magazine I've never read in my life, but I understand they have some good journalism in
it. Very good stuff in it, sure. And I there was a young woman in my class who was ran the feminist magazine, undergraduate magazine at Yale, and I learned a lot from her about what's going on now and her, you know, the attitudes of young women now as opposed to 10, 15 years ago. Kind of fun.
Well, why don't we talk for a bit about Expensive Habits? I certainly enjoyed the book. It is a book that is sometimes difficult because I noticed that you changed tense a number of times throughout the book. Now, I thought that was a very unusual approach, and at first, when the tense changed, I thought perhaps I was hearing the voice of somebody else, but I don't think I really was. Tell me a little bit about why you decided to approach Expensive Habits in this particular way.
You know, it's funny. I don't think it was a conscious decision at all, but I think that it evolved that way, and then I really felt the material would work for me. Past and present overlapping in a kind of collage, and people, at times it also goes quickly from a third person to a first person. There's a kind of slippage. I felt that the woman, Margaret Flood, whose book it really is, in reconstructing her life and telling stories from the past, is trying to write the present, trying to make the present square and tell the truth, maybe for the first time in her life. She doesn't quite bring it off. She's still deceiving herself in places. But the interesting thing to me was there that she goes quickly from these tales of the past to the immediate importance of those tales, say of her family, of her Irish Catholic family, of the grandfather who made all the money and lost it. She goes from these tales right to the immediate present of what she did with that material, why she told it wrong or wrote it wrong the first time, so that I felt the past and present came together very closely, were alive at one time, and that's, I think, eventually how that mode or how that style came about, that technique, whatever, in this book.
Well, I think it works all right, although I have a feeling that any book that uses present tense is more consciously literary in its approach than books that don't. I could be wrong about that, but that's a feeling that I have. Do you have that, or do you not? No, you don't.
Not really. The present is, present tense is immediate, and in many cases, it's the present tense is almost necessary because it's a voice. It's a voice talking at you.
Mm-hmm.
When people are making their claims rather directly, and a voice is speaking, Eudora Welty does that a lot. People are giving, using a present, as though in fact you were right there. You were right there, and I had your ear.
Well, you also use another device that conjoins with everything else. That's the use of Margaret Flood's blank book, which is still her voice, just a different way of approaching her story, I guess.
Yeah.
I felt that you were on very familiar ground in some respects. You mentioned the wealthy grandfather lost all his money. Well, as I recall, your grandfather was an asphalt, wasn't he?
Yes, asphalt. He was, yeah, contractor.
You know, and, of course, the Margaret Flood begins in Connecticut, where you did. It's Irish Catholic, as you are. Or were, are.
Well,
I guess you never stop being that.
I guess you don't quite know.
Yeah, there were academic influences living on the campus with her first husband, and so
mm-hmm,
there were.
Mm-hmm.
You used a lot of familiar a background that was familiar to you in order to put this together. I suppose that is a good thing to do because I hear now you teach creative writing and. It's been 30 years since I've taken a creative writing course, but it seems to me I can hear my old professor breathing into my ear and saying something, write about what you know.
Yeah.
And if you were to write about a West Virginia coal miner and his family in Appalachia, would this be put a bigger burden on you to tell the story?
Oh, I think it would be a tremendous burden on me. Though I think, and I probably would do it badly, or that would probably turn out awfully literary. I'd take it from places I'd take it from newspapers or the printed page, not from any sense of reality, or maybe go and research it. I don't know. But still, it might not have the ring of authenticity. I think you write about what you know, or you the premise here was to start with that. Because actually, what happens to this woman is she goes far from what she knows. She twists and turns and doesn't tell the truth about her past and departs from known material and, in fact, is writing about things, has written about things that she appropriates. American life in the 60s that she writes about, and kind of film script that she does, which is about down-home country music people, and she all of that she does in a kind of modish, stylish way, and it's for her it's a manner of selling out, using material, appropriating, picking it up wherever. At one point, the old radical woman says to her, the one who's really kept the course and kept the faith with her radical belief, says to her, "It's all grist for the mill, for you." And, in fact, that's one of her great sins. One of her expensive habits is that life has been all grist for the mill. She hasn't stopped to think how she's using the stories around her. She knows that, but she has a long way to go from the place, the moment when the book begins, when she starts to enter in to this confessional mode, to the end.
You seem to have some affinity for the city of Baltimore, since many of the scenes are set there. How did that enter into your mind?
That came about simply because I did know when I was young. When I was young, doesn't that sound wonderful? When I was young, I did know. Johns Hopkins was one of those very special medical schools. I mean, there are a lot of special medical schools, but Johns Hopkins was particularly famous. And I happened to know a whole bunch of people who went there to medical school. And so I was always fascinated with its particular fame at that time and had visited Baltimore a bit. It's a beautiful town now. And that, in effect, I did research. We went down, my husband and I went down and spent a marvelous amount of time poking around the eastern shore of Maryland and looking long at Baltimore and talking to people we know in Baltimore. It's a man who's transplanted to a medical career in Baltimore and lives in a stylish... To tell you the truth, someone like Jack Flood, the doctor, the successful doctor, now that I think of it, people like that live in the same way no matter what town they live in, because he hasn't thought deeply about his life. He marries a silly suburban woman who you could put down in any number of suburbs in America. She's quite shallow
I have a feeling Jack began to redeem himself at the end. He had made up his mind that he was going to leave the shallowness, and but not for the reasons that he used before with regard to Margaret. So I saw some... As a matter of fact, both of the husbands in the book had dramatic turnabouts in my mind.
Yeah, well, Jack Flood is obviously someone who partially threw Margaret and... colliding with her once again, partially through the sense of his own failure, though he's very successful in many ways, the great things he wanted to do he never accomplished. And she makes him face this, and he really does, at the end of the novel, I certainly, writing it, felt this was a man who was going to dig his way out.
Now the other husband, whose name escapes me.
Pinky. Pinkham Strong.
Pinkham Strong. He changed because of his seeing this particularly violent murder in his store. That seemed to shock him, I guess. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
That is the motivating factor in his stopping to drink and becoming a decent guy.
Well, he's romanticized life, and he'd played roles, and he's been, the last of a rich, last... son of a kind of run-down, rich society family who'd always just played with life and stepped from one adventure to another. The kind of man who, I don't know, I've met around a good deal. The sort of person who does a good deal of fine skiing and mountain climbing and hunting and a breed that still goes on, sailing, and yet... walks easily from one role to another. And finally he has to grow up too. What happens to him and Margaret brings him up short, and there can be no more games, no more nonsense.
I was shocked by that turn of events. The murder was so unexpected to me, because I was watching closely the interrelationship of all of these people, and all of a sudden, from out of the blue, this violence happens. This is not characteristic of you, is it now?
Mm.
You don't normally shock people like that, do you?
Not really. No, I don't think so. I think that I intended that to work out in one way on a very, very in a very real sense, and in another way to be quite melodramatic, something which, by wasting their days and not paying attention, Pinky and Margaret had neglected. Everybody, all the adults in this book, just deny reality and have neglected what they should have been looking after, and they should have been looking after that boy. And what happens is, in fact, shocking. It was shocking to me as I wrote it, though I knew, of course, I was going to do it. It seemed to me that they never really felt there would be consequences for the way they behaved. And I think that there are consequences.
Now, you said you knew you were going to do it. Did you carefully plot this book? So that you knew exactly how it was going to start, and you knew what the middle was going to be in the end?
Oh, no. I never know all of that. But I do know, I do have a vague outline in my head only, and a few leads to carry me through. I think that I knew fairly early on that the terrible thing would happen would be the sacrifice of that son, that he would die.
This may sound like a very a naive question, and so you may consider it that. I'll take the grief for it. But it would seem to me that you could have stopped the book at almost any point that you wanted to. So the question is, how did you know when you were through? It didn't have to end just at that painful moment with Margaret Flood clutching the big rock in Vermont or New Hampshire, I can't remember. But up
Vermont.
Vermont. So it didn't have to end there. It could have ended earlier. It could have ended before the death even. Really, when you think about it, it could have. So how did you know where to stop? How did you know when to put that final period?
Oh, I think in my mind it had to stop with her almost physical abasement in what is both, I hope, sad and comic at the end. Her own personal tragedy and slight maiming at the end, where she sprains her ankle by falling into a hole. But to me, it could only end, of course, where it ended. No, I think that one of the ways in which the book works in my head is that at the beginning of the book, one of the things that she is angry about when she finds out that she is going to die, believes that she is going to die because she has a heart condition, one of the things she's angry about is that she says about the doctors and all, how dare they? I've always controlled the plot. She's a writer, and she's always made up the stories. How dare they call the chips in before she's through? And so she decides, well, I'm going to rewrite. I'm going to get everything straight away. And if I am going to die, and of course she's still self-dramatizing. And what happens is that the plot does, in fact, get taken away from her. It gets taken away from her by real events, which are totally outside of her control. And even after her heart is repaired and she goes ticking on, she still starts to control and rewrite other people's lives. She goes back to work she has begun, and she's going to start more stories in which she shapes and trims and fixes so that the story will come out just as she wants it. And then finally, with the tragedy that happens, the family tragedy that happens, the plot is taken out of her hands completely.
Maureen Howard, how closely do you work with an editor on a book like this?
Well, I have a fine editor at Summit, Jim Silberman, and I
tend to work... Is he also the publisher?
Yes, he's also the publisher.
Yeah, that's right. I met him last night at a book function.
Uh-huh. He's, Jim made very few suggestions, a few little things. That's all. Not much. I tend to,
See, you're so proficient these days, and nobody has to tell you anything.
Well, that's a horrible way to look at it. But let's say I make my own mistakes, fall in my own holes.
What does it feel like after you've finished the book and the manuscript is in and it's apparently finally going to the printer? Is there some letdown or a celebratory feeling or what?
There's a wonderful, odd feeling when the book is actually finished. That is the last word written with a pen on a pad. And then there's all that terrible busy work of getting a manuscript together, putting it into the magic computer machine and so forth, and working over the prose. So that all gets to be, I don't think writers ever talk about what an enormous amount of clerical work there is after you've finished writing and you feel that kind of elation that's wonderful. Then there's all this heavy clerical work and proofs and so forth. But you still have your baby. Then it's very odd, then it is taken away from you and it's not yours anymore. It goes, it's theirs.
Well, that clerical work, a lot of that has been diminished by the computer, hasn't it? Hasn't that made life easier for you?
Oh, yes, it makes life easier in the end when the final processes and all that. But on the whole, I think after the elation, then I go through a kind of postpartum depression and feel that, oh, dear, where is it? And I went around for quite a while after this book, and I can't reconstruct my feelings in the past. I went around wondering what I could possibly do with myself. Of course, I was teaching, and the house looked like a mess, and everything had run down. And I didn't have any shoes to wear and so on and so forth. I'd been obsessed. But on the other hand, my days felt very empty. I missed my book.
When you write a book, do you tend to make a draft pretty well all the way through and then go back to revise, or are you the type of person who just can't let a sentence go and you build as you go on?
I build as I go on. I don't do lots of... I go slow. I go slow and etch it, carve it out. I don't very often go fast.
What about an impact of one of your books on your family? How do they react, your husband and children?
Oh, I don't know. They're just fine about it, actually. I don't know what impact. They're swell. They're kind of used to it.
And they're not like critics, though, are they?
No. As a matter of fact, I would say that my daughter, when she was younger, I never had any knowledge of whether she had read my books or not. I didn't particularly want to bring that as a heavy scene between us. Mommy writes books. I don't think that's fair for a child to have it's hard enough growing up in America without having some kind of grandiose idea of what mommy does. I think that's silly. So I never made anything of it whatsoever. And yet I realize that she's a very well-educated young woman, and she's out of college, and I realize that she has read me quite carefully and has read this book in particular very carefully, and as a ma, I'm really proud. No, she reads it in a very personal way. You're right, but on the other hand, what I like is that she reads very well. By that I mean she was an English major at Amherst, and she reads just the way you like students to read, and you hope it goes on for the rest of their lives, that they really see how things fit together and understand what's happening in a book. I love that.
Now, you said that over the past 4 years, in addition to writing and editing the essay book and teaching, you did a lot of reading. Do you find that reading is, reading other people's work while you're trying to work on a book is harmful in any way, that you might subconsciously adopt somebody else's style or approach or what they're trying to say?
Oh, I think that's always a danger, and I think you have to be careful. But on the other hand, I read There were a couple of times during those 4 years when I was doing fiction reviews for the Yale Review, where I'd be reading a lot of contemporary fiction, and I tend not to write at the same time as I'm loading that new stuff in. I tend to go back and reread things that have been very important to me, novels that really have mattered and that I know quite well, but want to refresh myself on and know how they work and how characters are drawn. And so you're constantly in school almost.
Well, Maureen Howard, it's a wonderful book, and of course I've always liked your stuff, and so I was delighted when this one came out. My last question: in Facts of Life, you describe yourself as a sinner from the start. Now, that was some years ago. How do you describe yourself today?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Let's see. I think
Or is that still accurate?
Well, if I was a sinner from the start, then I'd say that I'm a I'm contrite. I think I'm contrite now. Maybe I wasn't then. But contrition has come upon me.
Maureen Howard, that was not a fair question. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to come and chat with me in this 30 minutes.